You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
The Wire.
That's funny. What does it sound like?
So today I'm doing a report on the actions of New Zealand Defence Forces in Afghanistan. I'm firstly going to speak with the writer and journalist of the Valley documentary, Paula Penfold, that focuses on two operations. Firstly, the Battle of Baghaq, and secondly, an SAS operation. You released last night the Valley documentary, which is in connection with Fairfax Media Stuff and Media Works, and covers two operations in Afghanistan and New Zealand's involvement in it. Can you tell me a little bit more about the documentary and what led you to making it?
So we started about 3 years ago on this project when we did an investigation for TV3 on one of those battles. It was the Battle of Baghaq in August 2012, which killed two New Zealand soldiers and wounded six more. And four Afghan soldiers were also killed in that battle. And we got a message from an obviously fake social media account afterwards. It was from a former soldier. And he said, well, that could have been a lot better, which as a journalist, obviously, you don't really like to hear. But it became apparent upon meeting with him that we really had only scratched the surface in that first investigation. And so we started looking then at the Battle of Baghaq in more detail. And as a result of that, we ended up starting looking at the wider deployment to Afghanistan and also at that SAS mission in 2004, which was also the subject of the Valley.
So in the first episode, you talk to the families of soldiers lost in those battles, and you really stress the importance that the public know this information. But does this not undermine like New Zealand Defence Force and the Armed Forces' work by investigating it so critically?
Not at all. I mean, the reason that we're doing it is because, as I said, soldiers have approached us. And the reason soldiers have approached us is because they believe that lessons were not learned, particularly from that battle in 2012. There was a court of inquiry. The court of inquiry didn't actually visit the battle site. It didn't actually interview Afghan soldiers who were there on the day. So it only got one half of the story. And even that half of the story, it didn't get right. And so I think it's absolutely fundamental in a society that questions should be able to be asked of the Defence Force. As one of the soldiers very eloquently puts it, it's supposed to be a symbiotic relationship between the military and society. And that seems to have broken down in New Zealand over the past few years, where they don't feel that they're accountable at all. They completely refuse to be involved in this investigation at all. They wouldn't front a single person. And, you know, we understand that there are some occasions on which operational security reasons mean that they can't talk about missions, but that time has long since passed in these battles, and so there is no reason why they shouldn't front up, and there is no reason why they shouldn't be investigated.
You just mentioned that you know the inquiry only had one side because it was only one side of the story, and they didn't go to the battle site. In your documentary, you talk a lot to
the Afghan soldiers.
And I know I understand that you tried very hard to get in contact with the New Zealand Defence Force and the SAS, and neither would cooperate and put an input into this piece. But how accurate, therefore, do you think this information you've collected is, given that you don't have the perspective and information other than the court hearing that of their perspective?
Yeah, that's a good question. And given that the version of the Court of Inquiry that we do have is full of redactions, it's really, really hard to get an accurate reading of what happened without the NZDF involvement at all when they refused point blank to talk to us. However, as you might have picked up, there is lots of information in the investigation that has come from soldiers, regardless of the fact that NZDF tried to gag them. So there are some who are no longer with the army who were happy to provide us with information. So we're really confident of the facts as we have reported them, particularly given, as I said, and you've pointed out, you know, that half of the story has never been told before. So I think we have a much more complete picture than the Court of Inquiry ever did.
Taking this a bit wider now, going on from your documentary, do you think, you know, the world's becoming an increasingly more cosmopolitan place with bodies like the UN and NATO holding an increasing presence globally? Some may argue that we're seeing the demise of the nation state. And what do you think about this, and how do you think this affects war today?
Yeah, I mean, I think So we interviewed the former Afghanistan President Hamid Karzai while we were there, and there's not much of that interview in the documentary, but the full version is available on the Valley website if you wanted to have a look. He's really interesting on that kind of question, in that he, you know, he was a supporter of the coalition forces in the first place, but he comes out really strongly saying, criticising the coalition forces, criticising NATO because of the way that their operations were carried out in Afghanistan. And it's really sad being there when you see that there are, you know, estimates that the Taliban is now in control of 60% of the rural area of, of Afghanistan. And so the question is asked by Hamid Karzai and others, what difference did that, you know, did the coalition forces make? And I think it's a really fair question.
We should be asking
that in New Zealand too. What's been interesting in other countries who went to war in Afghanistan, they've had really full, open, transparent discussions and commissions of inquiry asking whether they achieved their objectives in heading to war in Afghanistan. We have not had that in New Zealand. And I don't think it's really good enough if you're going to send our soldiers to war to then get home from war and not even have any kind of proper debrief about why we were there and what we achieved.
Yeah, so like going off that, in the final episode, which is called Consequences, you talk about the lasting effects of New Zealand's presence in Afghanistan. And as you said, you talk to the president of Afghanistan, and you stress there's been this increase in, well, he stresses that there's been an increase of radicalization and attacks, and as you just said, potentially as much as 60% of provincial areas being held. But how much do you think this is actually not so much to do with New Zealand Defence Force and NATO's actions or inaction, but actually due to the growing radical Islamic movement that's sweeping across the Middle East?
Clearly that is an incredibly large factor. And so there are, you know, multiple insurgent groups that the Afghanistan government is trying to deal with at the moment. And, you know, just to put it in perspective about how little we hear of the results of that, we were in Afghanistan for less than 3 weeks. In that time, nearly 640 people were killed or wounded across Afghanistan. You don't hear about that anymore in New Zealand, do you? But that day-to-day life and death risk in Afghanistan is really clear when you're there. And so that unrest in that country and in that region, I mean, gosh, I don't have the answers. I'm really not qualified to answer that question. It is really interesting to see, and I do know, having witnessed it firsthand, how damn tough life is there when you just don't know whether you're going to be, you know, the random victim of one of those kinds of attacks. Those sticky bombs, as they call them, can just happen in Kabul at any time. And it must be, there's this latent sense of dread every time you step out of the door.
In both the Battle of Baghaq and the SAS operation you cover, there seems to be in both cases, as you just touched upon, like a lack of concern and potentially even neglect for the Afghan NDS forces. How damaging do you think this is long term? And how does sort of this reflect back on New Zealand?
Actually, the NDS was full of respect for the New Zealand soldiers. There's a kind of deferential attitude, in a way. And I don't know if you remember, but in August 2012, there was an IED attack 2 weeks after the Battle of Baghaq, which killed three New Zealand soldiers. And one of them was a medic, Lance Corporal Jacinda Baker. And many of those Afghan soldiers that we interviewed spoke incredibly highly of her and how many lives she had saved that day. She's almost deified there. But we never hear that story in New Zealand.
But, I mean, we never went back there. You know, emotions were running high and it seemed like New Zealand focused on New Zealand and lost that almost coalition between them and that work ethic. Like, surely that has some effect.
Well, yeah, I mean, we pulled out of there pretty soon after that, didn't we? So, because it was too dangerous. You know, we were there as a provincial reconstruction team, but from about 2008, 2009, former Chief of Defence, Rhys Jones, admitted in that interview, we changed our focus to security, not provincial reconstruction. And I think that's one of the main messages that I would hope that people take away from this documentary series is, you know, we as the public understood that this was not a combat mission. This was a hearts and minds mission. And yet here we are, August 2012, going on the attack. Why? Yeah. Why were our soldiers doing that? What kind of mission creep had happened that meant that a hearts and minds provincial reconstruction team was even in a firefight in the first place?
I'm going to put that back to you and say, having worked over 3 years and now finished this piece, what was New Zealand's role in Afghanistan and why were they there?
Such a good fundamental question.
Yeah.
That's why we need to have a commission of inquiry like other countries have done, because I can't answer that. I mean, the government of the time thought there were very good reasons why we should be there. Nobody predicted that we would be there for 10 years. Nobody predicted it would cost $300 million or 10 New Zealand lives. I think that's that very fundamental question that you ask is the reason why there needs to be a really open, transparent conversation, investigation, inquiry into why we were there, whether we achieved what we set out to, and if this kind of situation were to arise in the future, would we commit our troops again?
That was Paula Penfold talking about the New Zealand Defence Force's role in Afghanistan in her recent documentary, The Valley, which is now online. Next, I spoke with co-author of the book, Hit and Run, and war correspondent, John Stevenson, to get his perspective on New Zealand's role overseas. So earlier this year, in March, you launched your book with Nikki Hagar, Hit and Run, which looked at the role of the SAS in a specific operation. Can you tell us a bit more about this operation and the focus of the book on a whole?
Well, the operation was conceived in the aftermath of the death of a provincial reconstruction team officer called Lieutenant Tim O'Donnell in 2010, and he was killed while on patrol, and the New Zealand Defence Force planned and launched a raid to seize the people that they believe were responsible for that attack. And in the course of that attack, there was a night raid in two villages in Baguan province, which is adjacent to Bamiyan, where the New Zealand Provincial Reconstruction Team was based. We say that they led an operation where six civilians were killed and 15 were wounded, as well as a lot of property damaged. And that was in part due to decisions made by the New Zealand Defence Force, particularly the SAS, and also the actions of their allies, the US, who provided helicopter support for the operation, both transport and attack helicopters, which fired on the village and the villages.
Mm. So your book received quite heavy criticism from military personnel and New Zealand Defence Force. How much did they work with you?
Well, the interesting thing is that the criticism was from very specific quarters, particularly in the upper ranks, upper echelons of the Defence Force, but also that the criticism was very limited. The people who helped us with the book were rank and file members of various militaries. So there was a huge range of people who cooperated. A lot of them were at very high levels, but there were also a lot of rank and file people, particularly in New Zealand, who felt uneasy about what had happened, who knew that had learned very early that there had been civilian casualties and felt that there had been a cover-up.
You touched upon this concern from the public, which the Valley documentary also talks about. But do you think the public has a right to know if these SAS forces are overseas protecting them and fighting for them? And having been sent there by their government, which have select committees and so forth, are you saying that we shouldn't necessarily trust the government with their military expertise and, you know, the rigorous training that the SAS undergoes?
I guess let's start with the fact that about the public right to know.
Yeah.
I think there's a very, very interesting comment, and a very profound comment in a way, by one of the people that are filmed in the documentary The Valley. And I should point out that The Valley is a very different topic from the topic that is covered in the book, Hit and Run, and that also Nikki Hager had nothing whatsoever to do with the documentary.
Yep.
So that was something that was entirely the domain of Fairfax and you know, people like Paula Penfold, Eugene Bingham, who were part of the stuff scene.
Yeah.
So I guess there's a comment in there by a former Defence Force soldier called Aaron Wood, and he talks about the importance of the relationship between the military and the public being based on, you know, openness and transparency, and saying that, look, you know, the public doesn't need to know about everything. There's some things, obviously, that, to do with security that need to be withheld on some occasions, but generally there should be a degree of openness and trust. And he feels, and I certainly feel, and so many other people that work on these projects, that the Defence Force over the years has used secrecy or national security as a way of avoiding criticism, or a way of doing things that the public actually wouldn't be comfortable with. And it doesn't have anything to do with, you know, protecting people on operations at all. It has to do with covering their butts politically.
But I don't think that's necessarily new to war or conflict. I think there's always been a degree of secrecy.
You're right. It's not new at all. In fact, you know, they'll often say, you know, wars are built on lies, both in terms of the reasons that people are given to go to war, and the lies are told in order to maintain public support for the mission. But, you know, are the SAS very well trained? Absolutely. Are they, you know, generally people that act with integrity and care in what they do? Usually, yes. That's certainly been my experience. But does that mean that they should operate without any scrutiny? I think that's a ridiculous proposition, yeah. Particularly when you look at the fact that they're, you know, they're trained, that, you know, they're trained and operating in our name. CWC's in our name, so the public has a right to know, certainly when there are issues that don't affect the security of operations. I mean, something that happened years ago, that there's no conceivable threat to national security if that becomes public and it's discussed and debated.
Yeah, so what do you think has actually changed societally that means that there's this call for transparency? Because, I mean, there used to be this trust in the military and the special forces that, you know, we just have to trust them and they're doing their job and they're trained. So why is there this call now?
You know, there are a lot of factors and a lot of complicating issues that surround this. For example, I think that people are very busy. They lead very busy, pressured lives in this day and age. There are a lot of different media. I think people's attention spans are possibly shorter than they were many years ago, when, you know, there was more emphasis on a handful of papers and not the, you know, wide range of stuff that you can get today, blogs and Twitter and Instagram and so on. So I think, you know, these are part of the technology is part of it. And that it's quite a distracting focus. It's not like there's one or two national papers that focus very heavily on things. Then again, you know, in previous years, when you had that more focused attention on limited number of media, you know, for example, in World War One or Two, it was all easier to censor. There's a lot of complicating factors. And I was going to point out also that, you know, because the nature of the media has changed and the economic model underpinning the media has changed over the years, there's also less interest and less commitment in recent years to foreign correspondence and to sending people overseas to measure the daylight between what the government is saying and what is actually happening on the ground.
I'm just going to ask you the same question I asked Paula, which is, given your research over the last years, and what do you ascertain was New Zealand's role in Afghanistan and why were they there?
That's an excellent question, and countries that have done investigations into their work in Afghanistan have often said, you know, we went there with the goals of making sure it became more stable security-wise, that we helped in its reconstruction. But there's, in my experience, also been a third reason that they've gone there, and that was, these are the smaller countries, for example, Norway, Denmark, and so on. And that third reason was to ensure closer relationships or build or develop our relationship with the United States. And I think there was certainly an element after 9/11 when people were horrified, rightly, by what had happened. And the world was rightly revolted by the slaughter and Washington and New York and so on.
Yeah.
But there was also, certainly amongst the Defence Force, and this has been demonstrated pretty clearly, a sense that this was an opportunity, that this was how we could get closer, or at least the Defence Force could get closer to the United States after years of being in the corner, or being in the bad boys box, as it were, after the nuclear ships row, when our military relationship had been downgraded. And we've become friends rather than allies. So I think there was a lot of political and military opportunism involved, as well as genuine revulsion about what had happened. And I think you can tell that by the fact that often when incidents occur and we try to get information as journalists, that information is withheld on the grounds that it could prejudice the relationship with another country. And usually that country, obviously, is the United States.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.